Hello, everybody. Well, wow, we're on time today. That's a kind of unusual for my show. And looking forward to it. It's going to be very interesting, as I've been advertising to all my social networks. Prepare for a sizzling hot conversation today. I'm very excited to have back someone who I've had before. I respect him infinitely. His name is Nick Redfern. The last time he was on, we talked about his book, Contactees. This man is a prolific writer and quite an expert on the ET UFO reality and so much more. I mean, titles like Body Snatchers in the Desert. We talked about chupacabras, another fascinating subject for me. And today we're going to be talking about his book, The NASA Conspiracies, The Truth Behind the Moon Landings, Censored Photos, and The Face on Mars. So this is a subject that has a very near and dear place to my heart. So I'm going to dive right into it, foregoing all other announcements, and welcome my guest. Thank you, Nick, for coming on.
Hey, Patricia. Well, thanks for having me back on the show.
I'm sorry we had those few little skirmishes on getting you on, and that we finally have managed to get the date and finally bring you on to the show.
Yeah, one of those things where occasionally things crop up called life, and things happen, but we finally made it. So.
Well, thank you for being flexible last week. As I told you, I had William Henry on talking about the Egypt situation because he was there. So, all right, well, here we go. Boy, wow, you are really a prolific writer. I love it. And your work is always right spot on the dime. So let's start by talking about, how do you do all this writing?
Well, I guess that's the main reason, I suppose, or the main way I'm able to, is that that's all I do. I mean, I work from home, and I work as a journalist. That's my sort of main job. So,
yeah.
You know, I sort of start in the morning about 7 and finish about 5 at night. So all I do is pan stuff out in front of the computer all day. So.
Yeah, I can relate to that. As I say that, I realize I've got 10 books myself out, so well, mm-hmm. I know the commitment that's involved. All right, mm-hmm. Let's talk about your book, The NASA Conspiracies, which is just really amazing. And I'd like to, let's take the leap. The last time we talked about contactees, and I remember we got into a very interesting subject area of chupacabras and your experience there. How did you take this next leap to report on the NASA, great title, by the way, The NASA Conspiracies?
Oh, well, thanks. Well, basically, Patricia, what it was, that over the years of, you know, writing books and investigating things, you know, from time to time, people would email me with accounts and stories that were relative to NASA and UFOs and related phenomena. And I suppose over the course of 4 or 5 years, you know, I collected a lot of information. Then when I was sort of looking for the next book to write, so to speak, one of the things I found was that when I went back and reviewed all the different material I got on different subjects, there was a huge amount of NASA material. Now, of course, you know, a lot of books have been written on the face on Mars and the controversy surrounding whether or not we went to the moon. But there hadn't really been sort of a full-length book that delves into sort of a whole range of different mysteries that NASA have been involved in over the years. And so I thought it might be an idea to put this material out, particularly because a lot of it had never been seen before even. So.
It's a great idea. The question is, you know, is it life-enhancing to title a book The NASA Conspiracies?
Well, actually, that was the publisher's idea for the title. But one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that very often, you know, when you're with a publisher, they actually have control over the sort of cover design, the title, everything else. And, you know, we went through, I guess it's to the point, you know, it explains what the book's about.
So. It certainly is. All right, well, you brought up a couple of interesting right off the top subjects, and that is, of course, the inevitable and permanently top subject on the whole NASA question is, did we really land on the moon? Mm-hmm. We've certainly seen a lot of material. Some really good books have been written about it. And you approach this subject in this book. What's your take?
Well, my view is that we did. You know, I mean, the book's called The NASA Conspiracies because it's a study of conspiracy theories leveled at NASA. But what I didn't want to do with the book was just, you know, write about the subject or the various mysteries from the perspective of just like a wide-eyed believer. You know, what I wanted to do was address both sides of the arguments and try and unravel the various complexities. And I think in terms of the moon landings, I think we did go. You know, I think there's enough evidence to suggest the astronauts did go there and came back. For example, you know, if you look at the moon rock they brought back with them, I mean, the moon rock that the Apollo astronauts brought back from the moon between 69 and 72 has been analyzed independently outside of NASA. So, you know, I think in that respect, the fact that there are people who've examined it have no, you know, reason to uphold any sort of conspiracy theory whatsoever. And plus, we know that the material, that the rock, is very, very unique. So, in other words, I think that's a very good pointer towards the fact that, that we did go.
Right, but there is also a possible consideration that there was such a pressure to beat the Russians to the moon. Couldn't it be that the whole very fake-looking setup with the films, One Great Step for Mankind, could have been a shot, and then at a later time, we actually made it to the moon when the pressure was off?
Well, yeah, I mean,
forward gathering the rock.
I mean, there are sort of variations on the conspiracy theories. One is that, you know, we went, as NASA said. Other theories suggest that maybe they went, again, as NASA said, but the photographs and the film footage didn't come out, possibly having been damaged to outer space radiation and things like that, and so that the footage and the films and the photographs were recreated. That's one of the other theories that's been put forward. But, I mean, a lot of people don't realize, you know, people say, well, why doesn't, you know, somebody just go back to the moon and photograph the area where the, you know, the lunar modules came down? A lot of people don't actually realize that that's been done, and the photographs are available on NASA's website. For example, on July the 17th, 2009, NASA actually unveiled its photographs taken by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft, and these photographs are on their website, and they actually show the lunar module landing sites and even the tracks of the astronauts walking around. But a lot of people who suggest we didn't go, you know, say, well, the photographs originated with NASA, so how can we trust them? So it's almost, you know, it'll never really, I think, you know, bring the argument to a halt. And I think one of the other reasons why I do think we went is that between when President Kennedy in 1962 announced the plan to go to the moon and 1972, when the Apollo missions finished, a course of 10 years, slightly more than 400,000 people worked on that particular project. Now, of that 400,000 people, not a single one has come forward to say the moon landing. The only people who have said the moon landings were faked are authors and researchers. There's never actually been one single NASA insider who's come forward and said something along the lines of, you know, I was the second cameraman in the studio, or I helped, you know, build the hangar where we faked it. That's never happened. And I think...
Well, I doubt that would ever happen, and someone would live to tell about it, you think?
Well, you know, I mean, it's like if you take a case like Roswell, you know, we have countless military people come forward, even things like the JFK assassination, you know, we have people saying they knew who the third gunman was or the second gunman. But with the moon landings, we don't have even one person who's ever commented from the inside. It, you know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't look at these theories by any means. But, you know, from my perspective, I think when you see the photographs, which today seem to show the landing sites from back in 69 and between 69 and 72 and the moon rock. And a lot of people say, well, you know, where's people talk about the astronauts? You know, they would say they would never be able to sort of stand the rigors of outer space exposure, things like the Van Allen belt and radiation, etc. A lot of people, again, don't realize that a lot of the original Apollo astronauts began to suffer from early stage cataracts at early ages, which were clearly evidence of you know, of exposure to radiation in space. Many of the Apollo astronauts have show evidence of those cataracts on their eyes.
Right, but being in a spacecraft does not imply that they were, I mean, getting the cataracts in the craft doesn't mean that that would have been an effect of walking on the moon. But anyway, honestly,
no, I mean,
we have taken
such leaps
and bounds since the moon issue that it's almost kind of a moot point compared to some of the other things you discuss in the book. that I'd like to get into, like Mars and what's going on there.
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the biggest issues relative to Mars is certainly, you know, the face on Mars. And I'm sure most people have heard of the face on Mars, even if they're not, you know, fully clued up on all its various intricacies. But essentially, the story is that what happened was that on July the 25th, 1976, NASA's Viking 1 space probe, which was orbiting the planet at the time, took a number of photographs in an area of Mars that's become known as Cydonia, which lies about 10 degrees north of the Martian equator. And a number of these photographs seem to show what looked like a huge carved head, human-like face, pointing upwards to the sky. Now, today, NASA certainly doesn't avoid talking about the face on Mars, actually quite happy to, but their public viewpoint, at least, is that it's kind of like the equivalent of seeing faces in clouds. You know, that their view is that when this is like a huge mesa from their perspective, and that when the shadows and the light are in certain positions, it kind of takes on the formation of a face. However, when you look at all the research that has been done by countless people within the Face on Mars research community, there's very little doubt, indeed if any, in my mind, that what we are looking at is a very ancient carved structure. I think there's a tremendous body of evidence to suggest that is the case. Now, of course, that opens up a huge can of worms, you know, regarding, well, who built it? When was it built? What happened to them? You know, when their planet degraded, did they, you know, come to the Earth? The mere fact that the face points upwards implies it has to be seen, it can only be seen from the sky. So in other words, that suggests possibly the builders of it, you know, had achieved at least aerial flight, if not space travel, you know. So the face on Mars, if it's a carved face, it isn't just the fact that, oh, it's a carved face. You know, it opens up this whole realm to different areas that, you know, these different implications and scenarios that may somehow even be linked with our ancient past, because what some researchers have found is that very close to this carved face, which actually quite eerily resembles the Egyptian Sphinx, is quite close to the face, there are a number of what look like pyramids. Obviously, they've kind of degraded over time, but they look very much like the Egyptian pyramids. Now, of course, when you have a Sphinx-like face on Mars and pyramids, you have to wonder, is there some sort of connection with our ancient history on Earth? You know, did they come here? Did they help sort of seed or even influence the technologies and the culture of some of our earlier civilizations?
Or perhaps even yet a different civilization that seeded both Mars and the Earth?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's one of the theories that has been put forward, the idea that maybe Mars didn't have an indigenous life form, but maybe, you know, we're talking about some sort of extraterrestrial race that has traveled the universe, seeding life on different planets over time. And, you know, maybe something happened on Mars where there was a huge catastrophe. They, you know, the atmosphere pretty much degraded and was lost, you know, the oceans boiled dry or whatever. And their planet, you know, spiraled down into destruction, at least from a, you know, life being on the planet. Although there are a number of interesting photographs that do seem to suggest there could still be vegetation and water on Mars.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that, because when you were talking about the NASA saying that it was an illusion and that it was like seeking faces in the clouds, I recall seeing some amazing pictures of what looked like complete forests on Mars, and then describing that as debris. And I'm like, no, these are trees. There's no question about that. Yeah. And what do you have to say to that? I know you've seen these images.
Yeah. If you do a Google search, on banyan trees, B-A-N-Y-A-N plus Mars, you'll see the photographs. And they do look, for all the world, like very unusual trees, you know, which if they grew on another planet, you know, they wouldn't obviously resemble, you know, to a perfect degree the sort of trees we see on Earth. But when you look at them, they do look like vegetation. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And, of course, you know, NASA dismissed this. Oh, you know, it's just the way the photographs appear. There's nothing strange about it at all. But, you know, when you see, for example, we know that the north and south poles of Mars have a lot of frozen ice. And on a number of photographs NASA photographs even, we see evidence of what look like massive shorelines, ancient shorelines of lakes and oceans even. So, you know, Mars at some point clearly had running water and in substantial amounts. Now, when you have running water in an atmosphere, you know, it's not, of course, out of the question. In fact, it's quite likely that life in some fashion is going to develop. And when we see these tree-like structures and we have things like the face on Mars and these pyramids, my personal view is that although today Mars, I won't say it's a dead world because I don't think it is, but it's certainly not, you know, brimming with life as the Earth is, but it's not impossible that, you know, 100,000 years ago, quarter of a million years ago, it may well have been. You know, it may not have been that different to the Earth. You know, it could be rich in life and vegetation and oceans, and then something happened that, you know, destroyed the planet in terms of its atmosphere and life. And
and signs of water on the planet, maybe it is not devoid of life. Maybe different than what we're being told.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at these tree formations and the water, you know, it's, some people have even speculated that even if the Martian civilization degraded however far back, it's not impossible that, you know, maybe they moved underground. You know, maybe there's an extensive civilization under there. You know, I actually don't rule that out. I think that's entirely possible that, you know, there could be, you know, the final remnants of this civilization, you know, hanging on, so to speak, and have sort of made good and managed to survive.
Well, let's consider that we know that all of the governments of the world have built extensive underground bases and condominium complexes and the likes underground. So we know that that exists on the Earth for whatever purposes they intend to use them for. We know without doubt that a world has been, I'm not talking about Shambhala, I'm talking about military and governmental cities underground. So the idea that it would be, we think of that as a last resort going into the underground to survive, but quite honestly, it may very well be that alternative societies exist in Mars and they're very comfortable living either completely underground or coming out at certain seasons or certain times when the environment is less hostile.
I don't rule that out at all. And I think, you know, as I said, when we see evidence of things like the face and these, what look like, it seems like forests almost, and water, then, you know, if you look, for example, at the North and South Pole where we have outposts, you know, that's a pretty harsh environment. But we, you know, these outposts and the people there survive quite comfortably. If there was an advanced civilization on Mars that saw this catastrophe coming and a certain number of them were able to get underground, then we could be talking about vast installations that kind of mirror the sort of underground installations we have right here on Earth. And, you know, with plenty of recycling of air and food and, you know, the ability to keep the place sustained, etc., it's not entirely out of the question at all. And I think there are massive mysteries surrounding Mars that just haven't been resolved and have, unfortunately have been dismissed by so many people within the scientific community, because I think a lot of them are just fearful of opening this controversy up, so to speak.
Yeah, I was going to say either haven't been resolved or haven't been revealed, because
we are not privileged
to know what our leaders are doing, but we do know that there are now three craft on Mars. Is that correct?
Three what, sorry?
There are three craft. Human craft.
Oh yeah, I mean yes. We've sent various probes to Mars, and you know there's no doubt that, you know, footage has been brought back and intriguing photographs. I just find it very strange.
There are three craft on the ground, supposedly collecting Mars rocks and taking tests. How many years have they been there, and what are they really doing?
Well, you know, again, this is the big question. I mean, you know, you would imagine if Mars is a dead world, there's only so much you can learn from analyzing a bunch of rocks. And again, this is one of the reasons why I consider Mars not to be a dead world, because to continue to research it for so long suggests to me that, you know, that there are people on the inside who know that Mars isn't just a barren world. They know that there are profound mysteries there. And, you know, if life is there and you know, this life somehow has a bearing on our ancient history. You know, the mere fact that we have this Sphinx-like thing and the pyramid-type formations does make a lot of people think that, you know, our knowledge of our ancient history is totally wrong. And I could well understand how there could be people in government who don't want to, quote, upset the apple cart by having to admit that our entire history is wrong, that maybe even some of our, you know, ancient religious legends are based on, you know, these entities actually coming from Mars to here and seeding life. You know, how could you tell the world that? And I think that's why there's been a lot of controversy. And I think one of the things the Face on Mars issue does, it's the potentials for opening up the world to so many different paradigms and ideas and theories actually stems from the Face on Mars and the implications of who built it and why and things like that.
Yeah, and of course, beyond the question of upsetting the history of mm-hmm. human existence on the planet is the reality of having to admit that there is life beyond the planet, which is still in the cooker, but we never seem to get the bottom answer on this. I just do think it's coming soon. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know that, how do you approach this in the book, as far as the conspiracy to keep humankind from knowing that there is life beyond the planet? What are they hiding? Yeah. Let me say this. Why do you think NASA mm-hmm. is hiding the truth? Because okay. I think we're pretty consistent about knowing that they are.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to government agencies and the whole UFO phenomenon and the idea of life in outer space, I don't think it's so much, if it was just the issue that, oh, we found life in outer space, I don't think it's just that that's being hidden. I think the reason it's being hidden is because there's more to it than that. And I think probably a lot of it relates to the origins of humankind. You know, for example, you can read a lot of ancient religious texts about the gods coming down from the sky and, you know, helping the people and et cetera, and giving them a way of living, et cetera. Well, you know, millions and millions and millions of people around the world take those stories, you know, as literal truth, that they're related to religious events, religious visitations. What if somebody in the government has actually proven or strongly suspects that these stories and legends are actually related to ancient visitations from aliens? You know, how do you tell, for example, you know, millions of people who support one particular religion? Well, you know, these stories actually weren't based on religious events. They were based on astronauts coming from some other world. So I think it's things like that that prevents government agencies from coming out and revealing the truth. And I also think there's the sort of economic angle, the idea that if, for example, we've been able to ascertain that, you know, for example, or discover highly advanced technologies from studying UFOs and things like this that could do away with oil overnight. You know, imagine if we introduced some new technology tomorrow and it bankrupted the entire Middle East overnight because we don't need oil anymore. You know, what would that do to the world's situation, which is also already very fragile? So I think, you know, the idea is that let's just keep all this stuff hidden, because to open it up to the people would be such a can of worms in so many different areas, religion, economy, everything else, that it's just best to bury it until the time comes when we cannot do it anymore. But they hope, you know, that's going to help happen in somebody else's term as president or whatever. I think it's the problems. It's not the issue that aliens exist. It's all the surrounding issues like this that prompt them, I think, to hide the truth.
Yeah, I think you've said it well. It's about power and money. It always seems to come mm-hmm. down to the money line, yeah. Doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, everything comes down to money eventually, yeah.
Yeah, follow the money line. Interesting, though, I wanted to ask you, is it true, then, that NASA is working with the Vatican to prepare the public? We know that let me preface that by saying, I live in Rome, so whenever it was, maybe a little bit over a year ago, when the Vatican announced that it was now okay to believe in ETs, I immediately got the hit that the Vatican was involved in the process of disclosure. So what is the relationship between NASA and the Vatican?
Well, a lot of people, you know, think, well, why on earth would a space agency, you know, be linked with the Vatican? But they really do have a very deep connection. The Vatican actually has its own observatory. They have a deep interest in astronomy and, the realm of outer space, etc. And, I mean, to give you an example, in November 2009, NASA issued a press release. This is a quote from it. This past week in Rome, as part of the International Year of Astronomy, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences hosted a study week on astrobiology. Their discussion ranged from what it would mean to the church if alien life were found to whether or not science needs religion. So that's as late as 2009. But if we go back further than that, for example, back in the 1990s, Monsignor Corrado Baldolci, Roman Catholic theologian, he was very open and vocal on the idea that UFOs, didn't adversely impact upon the Catholic Church's teachings. But in 2008, there were a number of intriguing developments. The Vatican announced, as you know, that it was okay to believe in aliens in simple terms. And the Vatican actually has its own in-house journal. It's called Los Osservatori Romano. And in May 2008, they published an article titled Aliens Are My Brother, which again reinforced this idea that if aliens are out there, then it didn't have an adverse impact upon mainstream religion. Now, of course, you have to wonder what is prompting the Vatican, who worked closely with NASA, to suddenly start coming out over the last decade or so with more and more statements relative to UFOs, to aliens, and how it's okay to believe in all this and it doesn't affect, the Catholic Church's belief systems. One of the reasons why there could well be a connection between NASA and the Vatican, if we go back to 1960, NASA contracted with the Brookings Institute to prepare a report on the feasibility studies and the long-term plans for NASA and how, it should deal with different areas and challenges. And one of the areas dealt with what happens if one day we discover alien life. How would NASA rise to this challenge? And this was, as I said, back in 1960, just a year or so after NASA was formed. And one of the Brookings Institute's recommendations to NASA was that if contact with aliens was made and the reaction of the general public would, quote, in part depend upon his cultural, religious, and social backgrounds. So in other words, what Brookings were telling NASA at the start, when NASA was just literally formed, was that if we tell the world one day that alien life is out there, we're going to need support from people with cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds, who can help get the message across in a fashion where, society doesn't collapse in on itself through fear or whatever. And now we are seeing that. We're seeing NASA working closely with the Vatican and talking about UFOs. So, this has inevitably given rise to the idea that some sort of announcement is on the cards, on the horizon. And what we're seeing now is sort of like the slow drip feed and testing how people are responding to it before the big announcement.
When do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if it's a when or, unfortunately, if it's an if. I think it depends what has been discovered, has been found. I think whether or not the news is good news, bad news, or these entities are totally indifferent to us, I think that is going to have some bearing upon whether or not the truth actually surfaces. Now, if these things are wholly benevolent, then there would be no reason, I think, to hold things back. We haven't seen evidence of outright malevolence in terms of them being hostile, but it may well be that they're kind of like the human race, that we do our own thing to benefit our species. Maybe they're coming here not to destroy us, not to, bestow upon us the secrets of the universe, but they're here. Maybe it's something to do with the planet, maybe it's minerals, maybe it's the water, maybe they're coming here in the sense that the Earth is a farm, and the fact that we see them and we live here is kind of a byproduct of the fact that, they're actually doing something else here. We think, I guess it's human ego, if you like, to imagine if someone's coming to visit the Earth, it's to see us. Maybe there are other reasons for them coming here, and we're just a side aspect of it. So, again,
maybe
it's
all
these...
despite us.
It's what, sorry?
I'm saying maybe it's despite us, because despite the human race, the Earth seems to be a a loving environment. And of course, mm-hmm. I don't mean to be speaking against people. I'm making a mm-hmm. facetious comment, but I have had guests on where we talked about, like, Stanton Freeman, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
When I asked him how he felt about Arrival, he said, well, if we could just stop shooting at everything, it'll probably go okay. there's a lot of truth in that mm-hmm. comment, and the fact that imagine an alien race trying to come to this planet to, for whatever reasons, like you said, and understanding that it is an extremely violent planet, at least from the military mm-hmm. point of view, and that they would have to be highly evolved to want to risk being victimized or antagonized by the military complex on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I actually don't think their reason for coming here is to bestow the secrets of the universe on us or help us. I think they're probably like the human race. We do what we need to do to survive. You know, we farm animals, we plunder oil and, you know, resources. I suspect that their reason for coming here is a self-serving one, in the same way pretty much everything we do is self-serving. I don't think they're coming here to help us. I think it's to help them.
Oh, well, I hope you're wrong on that, and that we have the opportunity to encounter some
Well, yeah, news. I mean, I would hope we're wrong. I mean, I would hope it's all good news, but, you know, it's like every planet, every life form on this planet is self-serving. You know, whether it's a lion on the African plains, it kills a gazelle to feed its family. You know, a bear, you see bears standing in the rivers catching salmon. No bear ever wants to help the salmon. No lion ever wants to help a gazelle. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter what the life form is. Every life form on this planet looks after itself.
Right, but that is the situation on planet Earth. I would like to believe, and I do believe, that there must surely be civilized, more civilized beings in other realms that have conquered that violent alternative to survival and have found ways to cohabitate with other species.
Oh, yeah, I agree that that could be the case. But, I mean, you know, I think when you look at, for example, like lions and tigers, lions don't hate gazelles. You know, it's not done out of violence. It's just done out of that's their food chain. You know, it's like somebody who eats an apple. We don't hate apples. We eat them because it's sustenance, you know. And I think it could be like that. I mean, it may well be that somebody wants to come here and help us. The only downside is I've not seen evidence that they have. You know, if you look at the planet today, overpopulation, you know, problems with the atmosphere, weird weather, rainforest destruction. And look at all the, you know, particularly over here in the United States, the burgeoning growth in diabetes and obesity. You know, people are getting sicker and sicker, and the planet's getting in a worse and worse shape. I don't see anybody from out there doing anything to stop it, you know, unless there's a bigger picture we're not seeing. But I haven't seen evidence, you know, that situations are actually getting better, really.
Well, in the law of karma, it would be pretty egocentric of us to believe that somebody was going to come and fix our boo-boo and make it all better for us when we have to learn from our errors if we're going to survive as a civilization.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a perfect statement, because if somebody helps somebody else too much, they never develop themselves. You know, it's kind of like if the mother bird doesn't push the baby bird out of the nest, it'll stay there forever and be reliant upon the parent.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, I think that's a good point, that, you know, maybe we're not going to get help until we reach that point where we're not just like a destructive species. But, you know, and it may well, this is obviously hypothetical, but it may well be that over countless centuries or thousands of years, these higher entities have visited numerous planets, and they have kind of a situation of not interfering, and some planets survive, you know, and other civilizations destroy themselves, and maybe these entities stay out of the picture until one civilization reaches that maturity. And if they don't and they destroy themselves, they literally don't interfere with it. You know, it's like, well, that one didn't make it, but this one did, so we'll help them.
Yeah, I adhere to one of the ideas that is circulating is that only when we become dangerous to the rest of the universe are they allowed to intervene. And that is becoming the case since we are now projecting all of this weaponry out into space. And we have had reports of craft hovering around nuclear facilities. Do you talk mm-hmm. about that in the book?
I don't really, but I mean, you're quite right. There's a significant number of reports of UFO activity in the vicinity of military bases, and even cases where reportedly at nuclear missile silos that the launch codes have been scrambled to right. Make it impossible to launch the missiles. You have to wonder, is that somebody sort of demonstrating a power on their part that, if one day we did go to war, would we actually be able to launch the weapons? Or would there be like a sudden freeze across the planet and everybody would be, no one would be able to do it, you know what I mean? It would just be, and then we would realize that something far stranger was going on. And I think that could be some sort of like demonstration.
Suppose they gave a war and nobody came. Used to be our slogan back in the days of
Well, that would be good.
War in Vietnam.
I mean, the thing most people around the world.
Sorry, Nick, I just want to announce your name to people. If you've just tuned in, you're on with Patricia Corey, and my guest today is Nick Redfern. We're talking about, as usual, many things, but we're pulling from his book, The NASA Conspiracies, which has been just, I don't know, how long ago did it come out, Nick?
About 2 months.
And his site is nickredford.com. So listen in as we go into the second half hour of the program. Nick, what's the story behind the, I don't really know the details about Gary McKinnon, the British computer hacker who tried to get into NASA's computers for evidence of UFOs and alien life.
Okay, well, basically, the story of McKinnon is sort of an intriguing one and a strange one. He was born in the 1960s in Scotland and currently living in England, in London. And he developed an interest in the UFO subject as a child, but he really sort of developed a greater interest sort of 10, 12 years ago. And, whereas most of us that investigate the phenomenon, we speak to witnesses, we do interviews, we do research, McKinnon did something that I stress no one should do what McKinnon did. he was extremely stupid and idiotic. And what he did, he actually hacked into NASA's Johnson Space Center, one particular area, in search of classified data on UFOs. Now, there's sort of a backstory to this as to why he did it, why he focused on this one particular place. And it relates to a woman named Donna Hare. Donna Hare was used to work for a NASA contractor company called Philco. And Philco, at the dawning of the 1960s, provided NASA with its worldwide tracking station for the Project Mercury missions. And Donna Hare actually became a recipient of a number of awards from NASA, including an Apollo Achievement Award, and spent more than a decade and a half subcontracted to the agency, working in Building 8 in the photographic lab at the Houston, Texas-based Johnson Space Center. And Donna Hare said that while she was working there, she got talking with employees who told her, one particular employee, who told her how part of his job was to airbrush photographs before they were released to the public, which contained anomalies, like circular-shaped objects in the sky, like typical flying saucers. And Donna Hare went public with this story in 2001, and Gary McKinnon became fascinated by it, and he basically said to himself, well, if Donna Hare said this material evidence was held in this particular building at the Johnson Space Center, I'm going to go looking for it. And that's what he did. He hacked into NASA. Now, of course, it doesn't matter if you're the smallest country or the biggest country in the world. If you go hacking into government computer systems, that relevant government is going to know, and they're going to find out. And that's what happened with McKinnon. And in the decade that's gone by now, literally a full decade since he did this hacking, where he actually said that he saw a number of photographs of weird structures in the sky, and he said he saw some strange documents that referred to, quote, non-terrestrial officers, which kind of made McKinnon wonder if we had like a secret space program, non-terrestrial being obviously working off the Earth, and officers being like a military flight crew or something like that. But whatever the truth of the situation, McKinnon's story now, or saga, has gone on for 10 years where the U.S. government want him extradited to the U.S. to stand trial. And his lawyer his legal team has successfully, throughout that entire period, managed to hold off the extradition and wants him tried within the U.K. And it's sort of like a gray area. You know, he hacked NASA, which is in the US, but he hacked NASA from within the UK. So the big question is the crime that he hacked NASA, or is it the fact that it is the crime that he committed a crime on British soil? You know, so where should he be tried? That's the area that nobody can kind of agree on. And why there's been this sort of to and froing back and forth of we want him taken to the US, no, we want him tried here. You know, and after 10 years, one of the biggest ironies is that had the issue been quietly concluded, you know, at the time, say 2001, and he was given a year's sentence or probation or whatever, nobody probably would know that much about it. But over 10 years, there's been so much publicity given to it that actually there's millions of people now who know, not only know the story of MacKinnon, but also know about what it was he allegedly saw on the NASA computers. So in other words, you know, it's the secrecy has been blown wide open by the fact that the governments keep arguing, trying to get him taken over to the United States. So, you know, where it's all going to end, we don't know. But, you know, this is one of the intriguing areas, you know, about what can happen when somebody sort of breaks the law to look for data. Now, what a lot of people don't realize, this isn't the first time this has happened. In 1994, a Welshman named Matthew Bevan, who was only a teenager at the time, literally working out of his spare bedroom in his mom and dad's house, hacked into NASA, again looking for classified data on UFOs, and he got arrested by Scotland Yard's Computer Crimes Unit. And his case literally went to one of the biggest courts in London. And what happened was that the judge threw the case out, and the reason he threw the case out was because the US government and NASA refused to show to the judge the files that they claimed that Matthew Bevan had hacked into, and they said he damaged them as well. So in other words, because the government wouldn't provide data to the British court, the judge threw it out. And that's one of the reasons why they want MacKinnon taken to the US, because then they won't have to show any evidence to a UK judge. They can actually just take him over and have him stand trial without actually presenting evidence. There's a lot of people don't realize there's this a new agreement that was signed a few years ago between Britain and America, which allows both nations to bring people from each other's countries, try them in that relevant country without presenting any evidence prior to the trial that the person's guilty. They can just literally order them to be brought over. And that's what happened with MacKinnon. The only reason it hasn't gone any further is because the lawyers have stopped it. So.
But I mean, it is interesting that I don't know what his background was, but let's say, let's call him an amateur, was able to hack into the NASA computer network. Yeah?
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, you know, you imagine that all these computer systems would be, you know, highly protected. One of the things that Matthew Bevan found out was that, you know, he would go into sort of the computer systems of one particular agency and see references to somebody, a professor who was subcontracted to NASA, for example. And what he would do, he would then find where that professor worked, you know, in his regular job at a university, and hack into those systems because that would be easier to hack into. And he would find, for example, their passwords. And then he would find, amazingly, those in a sort of an amazingly lax example of security, the passwords that the professors were using in their private emails, you know, at home or at a university, they were using the same password on highly classified government computers, and Bevan would just type in the same password. And, you
That's
know, outrageous. It's like the idiotic thing of people not realizing that, oh, you know, if you're working for the government, you might want to think about having a different password to the password you use at home on, you know, your Yahoo account or whatever.
So that's all right, let me interrupt you a moment.
That's why it was so easy. Yeah.
I'm going
that's why it's so easy for them to hack. Yeah,
hold on just a minute there, Nick.
Okay.
We've got a few minutes left. If you'd like to ask Nick a question, here's the toll-free number, 888-815-9756. One more time, 888-815-9756, and that is toll-free for U.S. and Canada. And again, we're talking with Nick Redfern about his book, The NASA Conspiracies. His website is nickredfern.com. Whew, yeah, we were talking about hacking into the NASA computers. Not a great idea.
No, I now, mean, I, you know, to... it was illegal. I mean, I don't recommend anybody does it. You know, he basically broke the law. Right. And even though people
I highly don't recommend anyone does it either.
No, you know, he broke the law. And even though he said, he saw interesting material, at the end of the day, he broke the law. And, you know, whatever happens to him comes down to the fact that he decided to take that a reckless approach to research.
Yeah, and actually, with so much information out available now, I don't really think that doing it illegally or certainly confronting NASA on any level is a great idea. I mean, let's just
If you're going to do it, you're going to get arrested. There's, you know, that's what it comes down to. So.
Yeah, but of course. Nick, let's talk about a subject that concerns me quite a lot, and that is the possibility of some sort of biological, let's call it alien viruses, mm-hmm. or some sort of biological matter that could be leaked from our explorations or just coming into the Earth realm with alien craft or whatever. I know it's kind of an out there subject, but how do you approach that in the book?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting area. A lot of people assume that if we ever find alien life, you know, it's going to be aliens and UFOs, etc. But a lot of people, you know, don't give much consideration to the notion that possibly what we'll actually find could be alien microbes, germs, viruses, that sort of thing. And, you know, the big question is, well, if we bring those back to Earth, either deliberately or inadvertently, you know, that they get caught, they get brought back by mistake, and they're then opened up to our environment, is it possible that it could kind of like unleash a plague on the planet that our bodies and our immune systems have no resistance to? You know, it's like, for example, the AIDS virus, which, although there's a lot more success today in combating it and giving people longer lifespans, you know, essentially without a lot of like a drug regime, the human body cannot fight off the HIV virus. But that's a terrestrial virus. You know, imagine something coming from another world. We'll probably have no chance of, you know, fighting it off. And there's absolutely no doubt that a lot of research has been done into this particular area. For example, when the astronauts went to the moon, or plans were made for the astronauts to go to the moon at least, what happened in 1967 was that in Washington, D.C., London, Moscow, various other countries, a statute was signed which basically said that, you know, if we go to other worlds and conduct exploration on them, we need to be very clear that, you know, we're not going to bring any harmful contamination back to the Earth that might result in adverse changes, not on just on the planet, but on, you know, the life forms on the planet. And, you know, when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon for the first time and they came back, they did have to be decontaminated because there was this genuine fear. Now, of course, this is like a hypothetical angle of what could happen. And it was actually portrayed quite graphically in Michael Crichton's novel, The Andromeda Strain, and the film of the same name. But there have been rumors.
Yeah, that's a major work.
Yeah. Yes. But there have been rumors, as I point out in the book, that NASA, possibly in conjunction with staff at Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is at the forefront of doing research into biological and bacteriological warfare issues, that supposedly at some point in the early 1970s, NASA and Fort Detrick worked together on a document, if you like, a 200-page document, roughly, that examined all the different data relative to what could happen if some sort of alien virus was brought back to the Earth. And there are even intriguing statements from some of the people, a couple of the people who've been willing to speak out, suggesting that maybe some sort of alien contamination was found and is housed in, you know, very strict security to this day to ensure that it never leaks outside, you know, and can contaminate the planet. But, you know, if it has been found and it is held in some sort of sterile environment, you know, that's a pretty scary situation, particularly if one day something happened and, you know, the installation was destroyed and this bacteria or this virus got into the atmosphere and, you know, and contaminated, you know, whether the human race or whatever, you know, it would be a disaster. We just might not be able to stop.
Especially knowing what we know about biological warfare and human intention to create viruses that will wipe out the planet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we only have to look at the way things have occurred in the past on our world. Things like plague, the Black Death of the you know, 400 or 500 years ago, it wiped out whole swathes of the population. And that, as I said, those are terrestrial viruses. I truly believe we wouldn't have any way of stopping an extraterrestrial virus. It would be something that our immune systems would have no way of coping with, because they would have no immunity towards it, because it would, you know, it's never been seen on the Earth before. And you know, it'd be ironic if some sort of alien invasion occurred, but instead of us being, you know, wiped out by hostile aliens in a Independence Day scenario, we all just got sick and died, you know.
Wow. I wonder how many people have ever thought of that aspect.
In some respect, it's almost more disturbing than the idea of being wiped out by an enemy, because at least you have the chance of fighting entities that come down in craft. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but you know, you have a chance of fighting them. What chance do you have against a virus that, you know, is so small that you cannot even see it?
And what did you say that you believe, or that, I really have never heard that it is believed that we have some of this virus under lock and key?
Yeah, basically what it is, this joint NASA Fort Detrick study implies that based upon the people I interviewed, the couple of people who are willing to go public who said that they worked on the report, there were references in the report to at least some sort of virus having been brought back to the Earth that may have killed a couple of people who were exposed to it, and it was just simply locked away, that no research has been... Basically, it was some sort of part of the craft or a craft that came back with the astronauts, or possibly an unmanned one. That's admittedly unclear, but that the craft itself was contaminated, or something on the craft was contaminated, or maybe it was like a rock or something brought back. I'm truthfully not sure. But the story was that whatever it was identified, and it was simply locked away and carefully, you know, ensured that it could never leak out. And no research apparently has ever been done on it, because it's deemed too hostile to even approach, you know, for fear of it getting into the air supply and contaminating us, that it's just in lockdown and, you know, never been opened since.
That's very disconcerting. Thank you for giving me that additional thing to be concerned about.
Well, don't lay awake at night sleep worrying about it, but hopefully it'll be contained for
a
long time.
I have a fatalistic attitude about life, and that is that we know when we're coming in, and we know when we're going out, and everything else is a ride to be experienced. Listen, Nick, as we're running out of time already, I guess I've got a last question for you, and we're gonna be out of time. And that is, how do you think NASA will respond to this book?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, what I've tried to do in the book, as I said, is not come across as just like some wide-eyed conspiracy theorists, and as I said, on some things, like, for example, the moon landings, I actually agree with NASA's stance, and what I've tried to do in the other chapters where, you know, I point out that NASA has had involvement in things like UFO sightings, crashed UFO stories, etc., and astronaut sightings of UFOs, is to use on-the-record official documents that have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, or quote on-the-record astronauts like Gordon Cooper and Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who've made very positive statements about UFOs. So in other words, you know, it's not like I'm attacking the organization. I'm actually quoting people from NASA and utilizing their own documents. So in other words, you know, I've tried to tell the story, but from a respectful perspective, but also a credible perspective of not relying on unnamed whistleblowers, but pointing out that, hey, you know, this is actually NASA saying this in their own files.
You know, what I have to say of the material that I've read and of the times I've had the opportunity to speak with you, you certainly are respectable and you certainly are respectful, and a beautiful balance between acquired information and theory. And that's what makes the book so special. So to everyone, I recommend you get this book. If you're interested in how could you not be interested in life beyond our planet and what's really going on behind the curtains of NASA? The book is The NASA Conspiracies. Again, Nick Redford, the author. Thank you, Nick. It's been a great, too fast hour once again with you. Thank you for coming back on.
Thanks, Patricia. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, everybody. That's it for today. Wow, how the time flies when you're having a wonderful dialogue with intellectual and brilliant people like Nick. I appreciate you listening in. I'll be back next week at 11 o'clock, Beyond the Matrix, for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. This is Patricia Corey sending you love and light. Nano, nano.